The first speaker at the September event in the Climate Change Lecture Series was Dr. David Elliott, Professor in Energy Research at the Open University.
Well, I've just spent an interesting afternoon driving around Nottingham, so I want to remind myself where we're starting from. This is not Nottingham, this is Shanghai, but it's the same sort of thing. A city with which energy is used like there was no tomorrow. Just remind us where we've got to change. We've got to change everything, I think. So the reason, of course, I'm quickly going to go through the reason climate change, something like 5-6 degrees rise unless we do something about it. And the reason it's urgent is, depending on your view, the worst case analysis on the left is if all the ice caps melt and the seas expand thermally, you get this at some unspecified point in the future. Birmingham becomes a capital city, so that's enough reason to start taking urgent action. Another reason for urgency is that the carbon dioxide we're emitting now takes a long time to get up and do its wicked things up in the stratosphere, you can see, and it takes even longer for it to come back down again and be absorbed into sinks, assuming we haven't already filled the sinks up. We're talking about 100-year type decay times, as you see, faster for methane, but much longer for carbon dioxide. So even if we stop dead now, the long time before this supertanker of a planet we've got begins to slow down and anything starts changing. So the later we leave it, the worse it gets. I've got to focus. I can't possibly deal with all the sectors in the UK. So this just reminds you that they're all different. Domestic sector energy use is still expanding, but not quite dramatically as the transport sector, where the big growth is. The transport sector is partly driven by you and I and our cars, but also beginning to be driven by aircraft transport, although that's still only a small chunk at the moment. And industry. Industry is the one area which is doing reasonably well in cutting emissions. I can't really go through sector by sector, so I'm going to just focus on, with apologies for all the other things we could talk about, just on the electricity supply side, because that's the one people most usually relate to as being the dominant issue, but might not be. I mean, if you actually think about it, where does most of the carbon dioxide come from in your house? Your cooker and your boiler. Gas is actually the big supplier of carbon dioxide directly in your home, not just in some power station miles away, but we'll pass over that. We're just focusing on electricity for the moment. This electricity, as you see, power stations put out an awful lot of steam as they cool the hot water, the hot steam that comes out the back of the turbine, and also puts out a lot of carbon dioxide up the chimney in the middle. TV companies tend to show the steam and say climate change is a terrible thing. Well, the steam's not much to do about it. It's the stuff that's coming out the one chimney in the middle in that picture that we're concerned with. But actually, the steam that's coming out from those cooling towers does tell you a story. Why is it coming out? What's it doing? Well, that's taking 2/3 of the energy that you originally put in to the power plant in the form of coal, gas, or whatever the fuel is. Is it being wasted in that cooling heat that's going out into the sky? And the obvious first solution is, amongst the various solutions to climate change, is to deal with that. So very quickly, here's your shopping list of things to do. Capture the carbon dioxide from power stations somehow or other. Stick it underground. Switch to fuels that don't produce so much carbon dioxide, that's switching from coal to gas. Generate the energy more efficiently, that's making use of that heat I was talking about, rather than wasting it, that's combined heat and power. Use the fuels when you actually generate it more efficiently at the point of use. Fifth, use non-fossil fuels, and the choices are nuclear and renewables. And at the bottom, another set of options, change the way we live. I'm not going to deal with any of those except number 5, because we haven't got time to focus in enough detail, so we're just looking at number 5. Nuclear, Well, I think I'm probably within amongst friends here in thinking that this is probably not your favourite option and possibly shouldn't waste too much time on it, except to regret rather that we're having another debate about it after I thought we'd seen it off once. So let's just pass on away from that. Unfortunately, we won't be able to do that in the real world, but for the moment we're going to move away to the real sustainable energy technologies, the renewables, which are driven effectively by incoming solar radiation, with some exceptions. Solar radiation provides the part of the energy for growing plants and animals and us, makes hot air move around, cause winds moving over the seas produce waves, the hydrological cycle of rain forming lakes and rivers and streams we use can tap in the form of hydro. So those are all solar driven energy sources. There's one other. Deep in the ground, we have the leftover nuclear material when this planet was formed, in the form of heat in the deep ground, which is geologically defined geothermal heat. And finally, there's tidal, the gravitational force of the moon combined with the gravitational force of the sun produces rise and falls in the tides as the Earth rotates underneath the moon and the sun. So those are the renewable sources. Some of them are more renewable than others, but that's at the shopping list for the moment. The first and most developed, of course, is wind. At the moment, globally, there's 74,000 megawatts worth of wind. Trying to put in that perspective, that's about the UK's generating capacity of everything we've got, all the coal, oil, nuclear plants we've got, and gas plants we've got at the moment in Britain. That's about 70-odd gigawatts worth of generating capacity. And globally now, there's about the same amount of wind generating capacity in various papers in the world, which is quite considerable since we started from nothing 20 years ago, effectively. We've moved on quite quickly. In particular, we're moving offshore. Offshore wind, I think, is a rather beautiful idea of having machines in the North Sea. We used to think of the North Sea seabed, anyway, as being the source of our energy, gas, oil. Now you might be thinking in the future of the North Sea being, again, the source of our energy in the form of large numbers of offshore wind farms. Also, the North Sea provides another, and other bits of the seas provide another potential energy source in the form of wave energy. This is the current leader in the global race to develop wave energy. Fortunately, the UK is in the leadership role at the moment. We've got more projects going on than anyone else. This is the Palamis Sea Snake. It takes the wave head on, and as the wave front moves down the flanks of this thing, it snakes about, and that snaking motion is turned into electricity. There's a 2.3 megawatt unit installed in Portugal and Spain as well, shortly, and one off north of Scotland and one off north of Cornwall soon. The other offshore technology that I'm particularly keen on is a very obvious idea. Why not take wind turbines and stick them underwater? Water's much more dense, 800 times the density of air. You've got much thicker, heavier medium. The speed of water is not that different from the average speed of wind in many places. I mean, 4 knots, 4 metres a second, that sort of thing. It's quite common around the UK. Sure, not everywhere, but in certain locations you can get 4, 5, 6 metres a second, which is a lot more energy than it would be if it happened to be air. So put your wind turbine underwater like that. A lot of ideas have been developed. The big trouble is, how do you get them out of the water when you want to maintain them? You don't want to have to send divers down. So here's a sort of cantilevered structure you can tip up, like the one at the back, to be able to easily get access to the blades for maintenance. There's some amazing engineering going on in the world. There are at the moment about 65 wave and tidal projects around the world. About a third of them are in the UK. We really are seeing the biggest burst of innovation in this field. Hundreds of people now going to sea in all different types of technologies. It's the sort of creative, innovative phase where it's very exciting. You wouldn't know about this if you relied on the British media. You hardly hear about this sort of thing. They're fixated on big schemes like the tidal barrage on the Severn Estuary, which I think it's being talked up rather too much. Who on earth wants to put an 11.5-mile concrete dam across the Severn Estuary to generate power? You know, eight gigawatts of power in the middle of the night. What use is that? Most of the time, it won't match demand. You'll have a lot of power available in the middle of the night when you don't need it. Other times, you'll have too much power in the middle of the night when you don't. And the other way around, you're just not matching to power. This sort of technology, the tidal stream technology, is a much more flexible approach. You can have hundreds, probably thousands, of small modular tidal turbines like this in bits of estuaries offshore all around the coast. We'll come back to that as an advantage of that. If you do want to have impounded structures and capture a high level of water and put it behind a dam, don't build a dam across the estuary. Just build a sort of impounded reservoir in the estuary. Then you just contain this water. You can have it in divided segments, so you can let one drain and then another one drain and then a third drain in sequence, so you get more continuous power that way. And these are called tidal lagoons, and there's a proposal for one off Swansea in Swansea Bay. Much more flexible technology, not so environmentally invasive, because you're not damming up the entire estuary. Just moving on, other renewables. Well, there's photovoltaic, which I'm sure everybody here knows enough about not to be to go on. This is on top of the Sainsbury's retail outlet down in Greenwich. There's Sue Rolfe's house down in Oxford, the first solar house in Britain. And considering Germany's got 2,200 times more PV projects, I won't talk about British PV anymore because it's a bit embarrassing. We could have a lot of biomass in this country. 15 years ago, the Department of Trade and Industry said half our renewable energy is going to come from biomass by 2010, especially grown energy crops like this elephant grass. Well, it hasn't happened. The biomass program in Britain has been a disaster, is the simplest way of putting it. It hasn't occurred. It's very slowly moving ahead compared with the wind program, which is moving ahead slowly, so slightly different. This is tragic, given that the UK has probably got the world's best renewable resource per capita, certainly, of any country in the world. Here's a DTI Carbon Trust estimate of what you could be getting by 2050 at reasonable cost levels. You see, you can add them up and you get something like 50% of UK electricity by 2050. And this isn't pushing the margins. This really isn't pushing hard. This is sort of middle range estimates. This is the programme we've got at the moment to 2015, 15%. And this is partly because people like me spend an awful long time in the corridors of Westminster muttering in the ears of ministers, and we thought we'd better keep it simple. So that, well, I used to mutter to them as a 10 by 10, 15 by 15, 20 by 20, as you went through up and down the lifts. If you say that enough times, when they're asked what the policy is, oh, 10 by 10, 10 by 15. So we're on 15 by 15 now, maybe 20 by 20, although they're a bit flaky on that. Here's what 15 by 15 looks like. A lot of onshore, nearly as much offshore, beginning to be quite a lot of biomass energy crops, if you believe that. A little bit of tiny marine, wave and tidal. We don't like wave and tidal in Whitehall, I'm afraid. I'm not sure why. A lot of landfill gas, because small hydro, large hydro and waste. Well, we're not going to make that. We're not going to make 15 by 15. One of the reasons is resistance from the squirearchy out there to wind farms. And I live in rural Buckinghamshire and I know all about how people feel about local projects. And you try moving a phone box in our village. My wife's the chair of the parish council. It could take a good 3 months of negotiating to move the phone box 200 yards because it's been there. It's always been there. You stick some wind turbines up, you're going to get opposition. There's been a lot of opposition. Unfortunately, there's all sorts of reasons why we've made it worse than it need be. the funding system in Britain, which I'll talk about later, is tragic. Effectively, it forces the companies to go for the windiest sites they can find. The renewables obligation is a profit-led system, which makes the companies invade insensitive sites. So you've almost created the backlash by devising an economic system which no one else in the world is using. Everyone else in Europe, with one or two exceptions, using a different scheme which doesn't produce the same effect. Surprise, surprise, you don't get opposition to wind farms in Denmark or Germany or France. Oh, you do in France, sorry. That's because you've got some retired Brits living a lot in Aquitaine that sort of, I came here to get away from that sort of thing, you know. In Denmark, the situation is very interesting, although we're getting NIMBY-type reactions in Britain. In Denmark, most of the wind turbine projects are locally owned. When I say most, like sort of 85%. I've been there a lot. They say, well, Denmark's fairly flat. These things look good. It makes something to look at, you know, because it's sort of something that sticks up vertically. Anyway, they're ours, and your own pigs don't smell. And anyway, every time they run, kroners, they don't have euros, by the way, kroners drop into your bank, and we're very happy with this. We get our own electricity for free, we make money from it, and we're saving the planet, and we don't have to worry about being flooded. So every little village in Denmark has banded together. You'll get 200 or 300 people like this group here forming a co-op, going to the bank manager and saying, we want to put a wind farm up. And he said, oh, how much is that? 20 million kroners? No problem. I'll give you a 1%, 2% rate of return, you know, interest rate. Everyone's happy. The bank manager's pedals around on his bike, handing out money to local villagers to put wind farms up, and so on and so forth. Now, no objections, very few objections. Same in Germany, something like half the wind farms in Germany are locally owned. Don't you realise that? A lot of them by farmers, but not by big companies. In Britain, there are two co-ops. All the other projects, that's the other 98%, are owned by large companies, most of whom are foreign, French or German. E.ON or EDF own most of the British wind farms. Other problem for why wind might be a problem in the future is the intermittency one. Now, this is tricky, so I'll have to take my time with it. Surely it's hopeless. The wind only blows every now and again, so wind turbines are going to be sat there not moving half the time. Not true. Typically, wind turbines run about 70% of the time at some amount of output. They're not, won't be turning anywhere near full output all the time. At about 30% of the time, they'll be running at their full rated capacity. But 70% of the time, they'll be getting some power output. So that's the first thing. Second thing, we've got them all linked up to the national grid. We spent a lot of money building the national grid. And one of the reasons we did that is because we've got a lot of big power stations. And the big power stations were the way things were done. But the trouble with big power stations, if they crap down, break down, shut up, collapse, you've got a real problem. You've only got 10 big power stations in the UK, effectively. Two of those break down on the same day. You've got a real problem, right? And they do. So you have a national grid which balances out the power around the country. It is designed to cope with two power stations, well, not maybe top one and another one on maintenance schedule, but two effectively being out of order at any one time. So you can shunt power around the country. That's why we have the national grid, to balance out the loads. Wind farms, tiny little things, 20 megawatt wind farms against gigawatt power stations. You wouldn't even notice the variation in wind locally until you're up to about 20 or 30% of UK electricity coming from wind. The shift operators in the old National Power Control Room, I used to work in it, wouldn't even be able to detect the variation in wind. It would just be lost in the already variation of the existing power stations, and also the variation in demand and the variation in temperature. The temperatures change, the amount of power on the wire, losses on the wire changes. You know, there's a lot of variation in the system. Variation of the wind thing is pretty trivial as far as power engineering people are concerned until it starts getting above 20 or 30%. Then you have to start thinking about what happens on those occasional days when there literally isn't any wind in the south of UK or in the north. It's usually windy somewhere in Britain. It's a big island, 600 miles, and if you're going out offshore as well, you're extending the footprint further out to sea. So you've actually got a bigger catchment area, right? So you're going to be very unlikely not to have power coming from some of the wind farms, somewhere in the country. But there might be the odd time when it's very low. Well, this has already been faced. We're nowhere near that now. We're getting 1% of our electricity from wind at the moment in the UK, roundabout. But in Denmark, they're getting 22% of the electricity. They come over here and shake their head and saying, you've got so much, you're the windiest country in Europe. How come you've got no wind turbines? It's embarrassing. But anyway, over there, they've got 22%. And what they do in the rare times they need to balance is to buy in electricity from Sweden and Norway for their hydro projects. That's not much of a problem. The real problem in Denmark is when they've got too much. At night in western Denmark, the whole country, the whole of the western Denmark is running off the wind farms. That's all there is. Everything else is switched off. It's the cheapest source, so that's what they run. So sometimes during the windy periods when you've got low demand at night, you've got too much power, so they sell that back to other countries in the hope of offloading it on them. So the problem is too much wind, not too little. At some point, you may have problems backing up variations, sudden variations. When power stations, coal-fired power plants, nuclear plants break down, they break down suddenly in nanoseconds, instantly loss of power. With the wind, well, the power would drain off over half an hour, 2 hours, no problem. We've got time to respond. And we do it already on the grid by having a whole series of power stations ready to crank up if there's a big surge in demand. If Coronation Street's on and everyone's boiling up tea after it, you plug on a couple of power stations on extra to the grid. All it means with wind is we do that more often. We have those spare cut plants that are running on standby. They're called spinning reserve. They're kept ticking over at low power. They're just cranked up to full power more often with the wind system than without it. So that makes very little difference to the economics or to the emissions because they're not running anyway. You just might put a little bit more load on them. And then finally, when you're talking about a very large wind contribution, over 50%, say, then we start talking about having to have storage capacity. That's in the future. We're going to have to start storing energy for all sorts of reasons. So intermittency is not the problem it's cracked up to be. I'm sorry I've gone on a little bit too much about that. I said earlier that intermittency was a problem with big tidal barrages. The barrage just fires off twice a day and the rest of the time it's sitting there as a lump of concrete. Whereas the tidal stream's much better, the tidal turbines. Well, here's the Channel Islands with sites for half a dozen different sites for small tidal turbines. And they're all firing off at different times because, as you know, the tide hits at different hours, a couple of hours later around the coast. If you go around the UK, you get some 5 or 6 hours delay. This is just around the Channel Islands. You can get several hours delay. So this way you can begin to balance out. If you're doing Fourier analysis, you're doing a sort of permanent input from them, right? So we've got lots of little projects scattered around. This is tidal, but also wave. Then that begins to balance out variations as well. So once you start having disaggregated system of small things, you've got a more robust system than one based on two or three large power plants which might suddenly shut down. So in fact, a renewable economy based on lots of different renewables all linked to the grid, probably more secure and more robust than one based on 5 or 6 big coal plants and half a dozen nuclear plants, which is what we've got at the moment. Could it be cheaper? Well, that'd be nice if it was actually cheaper. Pushing your luck, but here's the Cabinet Office study that I helped do with some other people 4 years ago, giving rough estimates by 2020. As you see, it looked like on current projections using learning curve, if anyone knows about learning curve analysis, wind looks like the cheapest energy there is, offshore a bit more, energy crops next, wave and tidal power next, PV a lot more expensive still, then the traditionals. With nuclear coming out somewhere around the same as wave and tidal. Now, you can argue about these numbers, and people do. The government's in the midst of an argument about it at the moment, but here's the latest government's... This is what should have been put out in this consultancy exercise they've just gone through. Not a bit of paper saying nuclear is a good reason for going, the only reason for is nuclear, and here's why. But here are the choices we could have, which would you like? Would be a much fairer consultation exercise, I think. Here are the choices that we could have, which would you like? You can go from purple, blue, whatever it is, dark blue, all nuclear nearly, to all renewables. These are all viable options, different ratios of different mixtures. They cost different, slightly. Their reliability might be different. I wouldn't like an all-nuclear system, personally. One terrorist strike, I'd have to shut them all down. Oh dear, what an awful thing. My friends in Greenpeace once said, getting into Sizewell B, they invaded the control room of Sizewell B 2 years ago, easier than getting into some nightclubs. In Norwich, I don't know what it's like in Nottingham. My preference is obviously the furthest right one.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I just have a few more minutes.
Here's what the government, I think, would like to see. Large expansion of nuclear, renewables expanding, but not much, and being pretty static after the 15%, more or less, that's it. We stay there. Nuclear expands to take up the future. Quickly move on. Here's what I'd like to see. Renewables taking over the largest 50% nearly with a bit of CHP, and carbon capture and storage with gas and coal being used in the interim while and storing the carbon dioxide as a temporary measure while we then continue to expand renewables into the future. Carbon ambitious model by CAT, Centre for Alternative Technology down in Wales, which I think is personally too ambitious. They're trying to get to 100% effectively renewables by 2027, in 20 years' time. Wow, that's really pushing it. 50% by 2050, I'd push. 100% by 2027 is really pushing it. And there's a big fudge in here. And this is bought-in carbon credits to tide us over. Oh, I see. So we ask South American peasants to sort of pump water with treadmills, and we get the carbon credits that they earn that way and claim against those. No, I don't think so. CAT is doing a useful service by saying it is credible just about technically to do this. That might help to say, well, if this is sort of vaguely credible, at least we can discuss that. What should we actually want? Which is something lesser than this, I think. So it's opening the envelope out to, I think, to its extreme, to be honest. The extreme being, for example, over 400 terawatt hours of wind. At the moment, that's much more than we already generate from everything in the UK at the moment, right? 250 terawatt hours of wave power. We haven't got any wave power installed. Well, we've got one tiny wave energy machine at the moment installed. I think it's a little bit utopian, right? Those are the lists. Yeah, 250 wave and very small tidal current. I don't know what happened down in Macunthlith. I think they got frightened by the tidal currents. Someone got swept away and they don't like them anymore. Tiny amount of tidal current, which I'd put much larger. We can niggle, but I'm not that convinced. And also, I have to say, it's not costed at all. There's no hint of pricing in it. I've got someone here that's written a bit of commentary about that, which I took very much to heart. So, sort of 5 out of 10, I think, to CAT. Let's go back to the real world. I know, okay. 3 minutes?
Yes, at the moment.
Here's where we are at the moment. We've got a European Union electricity target, which we are 10% by 2010 is part of. Yeah. Just remind you, then 10% by 2010, which is about the lowest in Europe. Every other country nearly on this list is doing better than us, is planning to do better than us, right? Why? I don't know. I can't give you an answer. Look, I mean, Denmark at 29%. So just feast your eyes on those percentages, right? That's electricity. We're not going to meet that anyway, our target. Worse than that, the European Union now just added an extra hurdle. We're going to not just get big percentage of electricity, we're going to go for 20% of total energy by 2020. This is UK at 2% of total energy from renewables at the moment. There's not a cat's chance in hell of us getting it. Here's where everyone else at the moment in terms of total energy, not just electricity, yes? Oh, there's Sweden at sort of 25%, everyone all the way down the Loire to the UK, right at the bottom of the list, right? Even Luxembourg's built. This is tragic. Oh, the Netherlands, Germany. So we've got a huge amount of catching up to do. Don't let anyone ever try and convince you that that Britain is the pioneer pushing ahead and everyone else is overawed by our massive programme. It's the smallest. Nicaragua is doing better than Britain, I think. The reason is, amongst the reasons, is the stupid funding system called the Renewables Obligation. My last couple of slides will just send you off with a sting in the tail. It's based on a competitive mechanism whereby companies compete to get hold of renewable energy credits, ROCs, renewables obligation certificates, ROCs, which are competitively traded. Everybody else in Europe, with one or two exceptions, use the different system, the feed-in tariff, which is a guaranteed price to everyone that supplies electricity. The utilities must buy it at a fixed price. The government fixes the price so you know how much money you're going to get 20, 30 years ahead. It means you can get money from banks at a low interest rate. It means many more projects have gone ahead in Britain. And as you can see, here we are, look. Every other country is blue, is using REFIT, Renewable Energy Feed-in Tariff. The countries that aren't using REFIT are all not producing much power, right? This is the percentage of power produced compared with their national potential target. So, right? What that actually means, our competitive system means in Britain, that some companies are managing to get projects that don't need it. The result is we're giving, through the renewables obligation, 740 million a year away to companies that don't need it, to E.ON and EDF, of course, are really poor, and take it out of the country. And finally, here's who's who. The red are the countries using a competitive tendering system like ours. The blues are the countries using the feed-in tariffs. This is why we're so far behind. I'll end my story there. Do something about it, I think we should. Thank you very much.